In 1908, when Henry Ford introduced the Model T, most people relied on horses for transportation. And while Ford didn't invent the automobile, he did have the vision to see its future place in society. And he invested in the infrastructure to see his vision take shape and develop into something ubiquitous and sustainable.
If I had asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse.
The choices universities and libraries make regarding infrastructure in the next few years will have profound implications for the future. For example, it's conceivable that students and faculty will evaluate universities and libraries on the basis of their ability to preserve data and to make it available. As economies become more knowledge-based, these implications are not confined to higher education. I'm Colleen Luckett, and on this edition of EDUCAUSE Now, we'll feature an interview with Saeed Chaudhry, Associate Dean of Libraries and the Hodson Director of the Digital Research and Curation Center at Johns Hopkins University. He's been involved in the Data Conservancy Project, one of two pending awards through the National Science Foundation's DataNet program. The Data Conservancy embraces the shared vision that data curation is not an end, but rather a means to collect, organize, validate, and preserve data to address grand research challenges.
I'm Jerry Bain, and we'll also hear commentary from EDUCAUSE President Diana Oblinger.
But first, research has shown that a successful mentoring relationship can help one integrate into an organization, increase career satisfaction, salaries, and influence in the organization, and decrease turnover rates. We gathered four academic IT leaders together for a conversation about the benefits and pitfalls of mentoring and leadership.
And our panel featured, in order of appearance, Ellen Cahane, Director of Information Technology Services at the College of the Holy Cross, Chris O'Connor, CIO at Harvard Graduate School of Education, Janice Thomason, who is CIO for St. Mary's College, and Avril Grant, Manager of Client Quality Services at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. I started by mentioning that industry studies suggest a shortfall of skilled IT leaders by 2010. I asked why mentoring and leadership is so important in the wake of this looming shortfall.
I could give one data point to explain the shortfall is the decline in numbers of students getting engineering degrees in the 15-year period from 1988 to 2003. The total number of bachelor degrees increased by 33%. However, engineering degrees awarded declined by 5% in that time frame. And for women in particular, a recent study out of Gartner explored reasons why women are leaving the IT industry in increasing numbers. One reason they found was that women are less apt to wait for the corporate ladder to come to them. The career path is too long. That's why mentoring programs are so important, because they can accelerate that career path.
I just read a study from the National Science Foundation, too, and they've expressed a big concern of a lack of engineering and technology degrees in the U.S. And as you can imagine, if that's the case, there's going to be more of a competition for this skilled market as corporate takes its market share of these people in academia. It leaves us concerned.
Corporate America is our competitor for IT leaders. They are siphoning off people that might take positions with us. So a person that normally would become a CIO in higher ed is now going into Fortune 100 world.
And it's certainly mirrored in Australia as well. We're seeing exactly what you're seeing here. And as an educational institution, we've always competed with the corporate environment, but it's just made it all that more worse. So it means that the IT director really has to change his attention from the things that he used to concentrate on to finding innovative strategies to help us retain staff for longer. So that's where we've been putting a lot of our efforts over the last couple of years.
Well, yeah, let's talk about, we're talking about the problem. Let's talk about some of the solutions that you guys feel are effective in terms of mentoring and leadership in the IT field.
We have in place a leadership development program within the IT services area, and that's one that I manage. And we've actually seen some really good solid results. We've seen improvement in our project management capability. We've seen improvements in our service management capability. And every 3 years, QUT does a staff opinion survey. And under the leadership capability, the results have all gone up. So we tried to bring that all together as a bit of a package for the IT staff, working on the base skills and then allowing them to home in on a particular pathway, whether it be general leadership, service management, project management, and incorporated within many different offerings is a mentoring component.
The Future Managers class is for IT prospective leaders, and perhaps they don't feel that anyone is their mentor, that no one sees the potential in them, that no one is promoting them forward. And a Future Managers class can be set up easily, similar to what you did. You need an IT sponsorship from your senior management, but you have a class, 6-week class, one night a week. The employee gives an hour, the company gives an hour, say from 4 to 6. You go to management class. You don't have a mentor, but you're presenting yourself. And in our session, one of our sessions, we said, mentees, if you've got no one out there who is on your side, you've got to do it for yourself.
At Harvard, that, you know, it is an environment, probably like most universities, that has a very good training in self-development program. And that's been very effective, even for myself, where I've had the opportunity to go to focused leadership training and then have an executive coach and whatnot, and to explore and be the best that I can be. And although it's not perfect, it certainly is an opportunity for someone to learn about themselves at the very least and to explore management possibilities. And actually, there's been studies that the mentoring and leadership programs offered typically are linked to retention and better job satisfaction, which then goes to a business case of saving money, people aren't moving in and out of your organization, all that. But that's important.
Formal mentoring programs can be very powerful. So I would recommend all IT leaders work either with their HR departments or find opportunities to create something of a structured mentoring program. For example, Holy Cross is one of the 28 Jesuit colleges in the Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities in this country, and we get together annually as a group, the IT managers, and what we found was there was a need to encourage and promote and support the aspiring leaders that were coming to this conference, and we had a number of very seasoned, experienced managers. So what we did was develop a program to match experienced IT senior leaders from one institution with aspiring leaders from another Jesuit institution. And that's been a terrific success story.
What about the person doing the mentoring? What's the motivation for somebody that's like, oh, well, I don't know if I want to get involved in this?
Well, I'd like to volunteer Janice for this one because she's impressive, the commitment that she gives.
We just joked about this because I really get close to my mentees, but that's a personal thing. My mentees call me up at night. I want them to after they've gone on a job interview. And if it's 9 o'clock, they've got my cell phone number and, you know, Chris and I went, what? I was like, I want to know how they did, you know. I'm passionate about my mentees.
Are there other people like you that you've met in terms of this sort of personal involvement with mentors?
Well, I keep up with my mentor of 25 years ago.
Was that a formally established mentoring
nope.
relationship?
Nope, not at all.
Because that was one of the thoughts going through my mind. The reason I was asking about the formal informal is I think the success rate varies with some of those. From a personal perspective, the best mentoring relationship I've ever had was I looked to this lady as my mentor. I never asked her. We never had that conversation, but I used to watch, observe, learn. Mm. And then down the track, we had that conversation. And she knew the role that she was playing, but we'd never asked each other if that was okay. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most successful I've had.
But it is very satisfying, Jerry, to get back to one of the questions that you had. That
sure.
I find it to be that the thrill for me is when I see someone connect.
Benefits on the mentoring side are at several levels. The organizational, clearly, in retaining high-quality
right.
managers. On a professional level, too, I mean, I think we as IT professionals, we've achieved a certain level within our organizations. We have grown an amount of knowledge and experience, and we should feel as a professional that we should pass that along.
There are institutional programs you guys have been talking about, but on a general level, what would your advice be to someone maybe that has graduated in an IT field and is working their way up the ladder in terms of getting mentored or finding a mentor?
Well, that would be my first piece of advice. If you're not sure, ask the questions
mm-hmm.
because they can either ask someone directly to be the mentor or you can ask a third party on your behalf to sort of mediate and set up the relationship. But most importantly, they have to understand what they want from the relationship.
You really need to understand that you need a network approach. It's not one mentor fits all. It's not one person's going to be able to address many of your needs. Typically, and over your lifespan, you're going to have many mentors as well. So, and I just would like to support people thinking about this, is that think about relationships. It can be as simple as, and I use this example, is that Last year I came to EDUCAUSE, sat next to Janice here on a bus. We started talking, exchanged cards. A few months later, I get a call, would you like to do a presentation? She says, sure, do you know anybody? I said, sure, I know another good CIO, and let's get together. And here we are doing a presentation. And they're actually mentoring me a bit. So, you know, it's relationships.
Well, I want to thank you guys so much for your time. Ellen, Janice, Avril, and Chris.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
A commentary from EDUCAUSE President, Diana Oblinger.
When we use the phrase uncommon thinking for the common good, we're really asking a question about what's in the best interests of higher education in the digital age. And of course, one of the first things to think about is that being in the digital age requires technology. That technology is certainly comprised of networks, but not just networks. State-of-the-art networks are required with adequate bandwidth and adequate affordability, and of course, policies that ensure equitable access, such as net neutrality. And of course, the network is not the only technology needed. We need applications, storage, high-performance computing, and other things. And along with those technologies, are new techniques that we need to allow us to capitalize on the networks and distributed resources that we have. New techniques such as federated identity management that requires technology collaboration and skills. So part of the answer for higher education in the digital age begins with the presumption of having the capabilities of the digital age, whether those are technologies, policies, or skills. And of course, being in the digital age requires that we revisit all kinds of assumptions. One of those might be the locus of control, or some days, even the semblance of control. Today, there are lots of discussions about whether the locus of control is on the campus or in the cloud. Over the last decade, we've seen all kinds of products and services disintermediated. And consumerization is changing campus because students aren't adhering to laptop requirements. They're bringing their own devices. So control may be moving both above as well as below the campus. Of course, it's not just assumptions that we have to revisit, but it's the number of options that we have. Because it's no longer about just face-to-face or online, it's about hybrid and all kinds of new opportunities. Collaboration isn't limited just to the campus, and the monograph becomes much more than words on a printed page. And of course, revisiting our assumptions includes what defines research. Because technology and new techniques have allowed us to create computational sciences, both for science and the humanities, that augments our traditional forms of research through either theory or experimentation. And of course, in answering what's in the best interests of higher education, we have to go back to the basics about what really matters for higher education. And there are some fundamentals that really have never changed. About access to education, whether it's formal or informal, about research, scholarship, and innovation, which drives society as well as economic vitality, and about outreach to K-12, to communities, as well as internationally. So with all those things in mind, the question may come down to what should we do? And I think there are at least four answers. One of them is to remember the ultimate goals of higher education. A second one is to use technology in the context of those goals. A third is to revisit our assumptions. After all, personal computers challenged mainframes, and above-campus services will challenge today's notions, but may revalidate others. And finally, I think it's important to remember that higher education IT is a large community. It's really an ecosystem of colleges, universities, foundations, corporations, and coalitions. We have a lot to share with each other to be sure that what we do is in the best interests of higher education in the digital age.
EDUCAUSE 2009, where the best thinking in higher ed IT will come together in Denver, Colorado, November 3rd through 6th. You can find out more by visiting www.educause.edu/E09. The EDUCOS 2009 annual conference brings together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This year's conference offers a new, robust, community-developed program built around practical, tangible ideas you can take home to meet your own institutional challenges. So save the dates, November 3rd through the 6th in Denver, Colorado. Register and find out more at www.educause.edu/E09.
Saeed Chowdhury is the Associate Dean of Libraries and the Hodson Director of the Digital Research and Curation Center at Johns Hopkins University. He serves as Principal Investigator for projects funded through the National Science Foundation and has been very involved in a pending award called the Data Conservancy. The Data Conservancy embraces a shared vision. Data curation is not an end, but rather a means to collect, organize, validate, and preserve data to address grand research challenges. I recently spoke with Saeed and asked, where does data curation strategy currently stand, and what sort of breakthroughs does he foresee in the future?
In terms of data curation strategy in the current environment, I guess what I would have to say is we don't have much of a strategic approach to data curation. I think what we see now are a lot of projects, maybe some exemplar communities, but no programmatic effort that's coordinated across different types of organizations. But the Data Conservancy is trying to do more than anything, I think, is go in a little deeper into some of these very, very promising nodes of activity and come up with a much more coordinated and a much more cohesive way of doing this.
What do you see as your goals? What sort of organization needs to be in place to make that happen?
Let me start with some of the breakthroughs and then work my way, if you will, up to the organizational dimension. Clearly, there are some technical needs. I think as a group, one of the reasons we've been successful with the Data Conservancy proposal is that we've moved around large amounts of data through certain repository systems, and we've thought fairly deeply about digital preservation. We were involved in the Library of Congress's archive ingest and handling test, for example. And we conducted some analyses of repositories using large amounts of data. I think what that's led us to realize is digital preservation is a very hard problem, actually. And in many ways, there are many unsolved aspects to it. So when people talk about preservation, they sometimes refer to bit-level preservation. And while that's not trivial, I think it's a manageable problem. But if you think about a full-fledged preservation strategy that includes what happens when the web goes away, what happens when there are format migrations, what happens when there are unanticipated uses that we just can't even imagine, it becomes a lot more complex. So technically, we have a lot of work to do all the way from the fundamentals, making sure that our systems are robust enough and scalable and flexible enough to deal with the kinds of things that will happen over time. We don't necessarily have a lot of consensus or agreement in terms of how well storage systems perform. How often do you get bit rot? What do you do about that? What do you do in the case where there may be some sort of threat scenario where either naturally things compromise the system or someone may maliciously try and compromise the system? There are a whole host of these kinds of technical questions that we have to address and answer. Broadly speaking, in terms of if you want a vision about where we might think the technical breakthroughs might come from, we've looked largely at digital preservation as a local phenomenon, that you have a certain set of content and a local group, an institution, a very clearly well-defined geographical place says, we're taking on the responsibility for these content. There are examples. Portico comes to mind for e-journals, for example. I think what is also interesting is this idea of distributed preservation or curation at a distance, and certainly the LOX model moves in that direction, but I think we're going to have to embrace wholeheartedly that no single place is going to be the node for all the data, even in any particular discipline. We'll have these distributed data stores, and we somehow have to manage curation across those. And we have to use machines a lot more than we're using them now. We just don't have people to scale up to deal with things at that level. So some of the breakthroughs, I think, will come in this way of looking at what are the technical kinds of capabilities we'll need to deal with large amounts of data that don't reside in our local environment. Culturally, I think what we would like to see is changes in data practices. So a lot of the people involved in the data conservancy come from the information science and social science community. And one of them, the PI at UCLA, is Chris Borgman. And she used a phrase during some of our planning efforts of making the implicit explicit. We'd really like to learn from each of these communities and learn the best practices, if you will, and then share them and try and figure out what might span across different disciplines and start changing the way in which these data are managed from an earlier stage when the scientists are starting the design of their projects and say, if you could do these things to your data, it would really make a big difference for long-term curation.
If an academic library is interested in becoming involved in data curation, what are some of the essential elements they should have, for example, resources, staff, etc.?
Well, I'll answer that in an odd way because I actually just spoke about this at the American Library Association meeting a week or so ago. And as strange as it sounds, I've been watching the BBC documentary Planet Earth, which is just a phenomenal view of the planet. And I had seen the episode on fresh rivers just before I went to ALA. And what I said at ALA was that we ought to treat data curation the way the Earth preserves its rivers. And that sounds a bit strange. But in essence, you might, number one, think the Earth doesn't preserve its rivers. They're very dynamic and they're flowing and there are lots of uses and lots of different ecosystems and so on. But that's precisely the point, is it's not supposed to be a static, fixed, and dark process. Preservation is supposed to support this very rich use downstream. So I think that's really important. But what I think about in terms of rivers is they start in the mountains where you have the snowpacks and you have the rain and you have this very deep kind of cold storage, literally, deep infrastructure, and you need that. It's absolutely critical. The river just won't even start unless you have that. But it's not the only piece, and in fact, it's all those downstream interactions and different kinds of ecosystems and different uses that make it vibrant and ultimately feed back into the mountains themselves. Thinking about libraries, what I'd like to believe is that Hopkins is becoming one of these very deep mountain kinds of infrastructure elements. And I think we absolutely need more than one. We need many of them, but we don't need hundreds of them. Where other libraries can get involved may be in other aspects of it. Even if they're not holding the data locally, maybe they develop metadata expertise, maybe they develop data scientists, or maybe they develop tools and services that help you verify that data is being kept and the integrity is being maintained. So what I'd really urge libraries in terms of capacities and resource development is not to just emulate what we're trying to do or what anyone else is trying to do, but rather we need to think about this as a community and think about what is the entire set of needs we have. These few libraries may go off in that direction and build deep infrastructure. Those few libraries may decide that they're going to deal with the human element. Those libraries may decide that those particular disciplines are important because of their local communities. So having this much more diverse kind of ecological view, I think, is critical. I don't think there's a formula. I think it really will take a community view working with our scientists.
Saeed Chowdhury with the Data Conservancy.
Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to find out more about the stories you heard, check out our show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
And let us know what you'd like to hear. Drop us a line at podcast@educause.edu.
I'm Colleen Luckett for Educause Now.
And I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.